data is many things, but it doesn't replace experience and wisdom. It doesn't discern political context. It doesn't capture opportunities that are happening. So it's like having a balance of appreciation for what data does for us, but also a really healthy appreciation for what we need to do with one another to have a better chance at really evolving some of this work.
Hello and welcome to the Civic Hacker Podcast. I'm your host, Lori McNeil, founding director of the Civic Hacker Network and the Civic Hacker Summit. I'm so glad that you're listening to this episode in particular because I learned and continue to learn so much from the individual that we're going to hear from today. The Civic Hacker Podcast is here to enable more of us to join in a learning journey where we explore the vast array of solutions that are emerging in various forms in communities all around the world. And we dive into the immense pool of knowledge available from people who are leading the way in using data and tech for positive impact. This show is brought to you by the Civic Hacker Network. Our mission is to create and empower a globally connected community of people who are using data and technology to create positive social change. Civic-hackers.org is the place to go online to learn more about how we strive to do this. Now, this podcast series primarily features interviews and talks that are recorded during Civic Hacker Summit events. The summits are online events where a specially curated, invitation-only group of experts and emerging changemakers share stories, strategies, tips, and tactics for making an impact with data and technology. We all can make a positive impact, no matter where we're located, demographically, geographically, or even ideologically. The person we're learning from today provides proof of this fact all the time through her amazing track record of bringing people together for community impact. Her name is Deb Halliday, and she is a community builder, transformative facilitator, writer, artist, and yogini living in Helena, Montana. She went to graduate school at Columbia University for social welfare policy and does a lot of complex work around social welfare issues like health, education, early childhood, and housing at the state level or regional level. Deb also has worked for the Montana State Education Agency and helped build initiatives and models that led to significant changes and improvements in the rates of graduation at many public schools. She's a nationally recognized leader in multi-sector collaborations. Through her firm, Halliday & Associates, she regularly speaks with groups large and small about how, working together, we can have an impact on the communities we live in and the lives we share. I'm thrilled to share this discussion with you today because Deb provides such important information about how to use data and collaboration to initiate social change in communities. We talk about some of the specific strategies, methods, and philosophies that she uses to help people share in learning from their data and communicate with groups that may not necessarily be as data literate. We talk about the importance of finding a balance between using data and using human work to create social impact. How other considerations, such as creating environments that foster trust building, are just as important as data for creating social impact. And we get into what it is about rural communities that makes them such great models for how to achieve social impact through collaboration. Enjoy this conversation with Deb Halliday from Halliday & Associates.
Deb Halliday, thank you so much for being here with us at the summit. It is such a great, I don't want to call it an honor. I feel like that sounds a little fangirl, but I am very excited to get to connect with you and talk with you. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Lori. I'm just thrilled that you would invite me into this great work you're doing. So thanks.
Yeah. So just right off the top, let's learn a little bit more about you and how you came to the kind of work you're doing, and also, you know, what that is. I think there are quite a few folks out here that don't necessarily know about collective impact frameworks, and, you know, definitely recognize that they have to collaborate across sectors. But yeah, can you tell us more about yourself?
Sure, thanks. So I am in Helena, Montana. So that's our state capital. And Helena is, or rather Montana is as large as from New York City to Chicago, with a population of Delaware. So it's very big, and it has the largest city is 100,000 people. We did just get a second congressional district after about 20 or so years of not having one. So we are growing a little bit, but we're definitely rural. And I actually came here from upstate New York. So I grew up in the Finger Lakes, which is a very different kind of a rural setting. I like to say that my belief in our ability to come together and do good work together was sort of, you know, deeply entrenched in the land that I lived. I grew up in the Five Nations are there, which is really the birth of democracy, is learning from these different Native tribes of how they made decisions and the space they gave women to be a meaningful part of community. And so really was raised by in a political household that was very active in the community, single mother. And so from a very young age, really got it that a good functioning community, whether it's your school or your parents, friends, or the neighborhood you live in, really matters, because I had a lot of time on my own. And so being in good community with others really was pretty critical to my own upbringing. And so I think I came into my adult life feeling very both grateful for having been raised by lots of people who kept me safe and have kept me growing and learning, particularly in school. And so wanting to give back to that in my grown up life. And moved first to Portland, Oregon, and then moved to Montana about 30 years ago. So I've really lived in the sort of rural West for most of my adult life. And pretty early on, grew into the space of being kind of a convener. So really kind of understanding to some extent, intuitively, how important it is to bring people together, but then learned a lot. I went to grad school at Columbia University for social welfare policy.
Go Lions.
Whoop, whoop.
Sorry, I had to.
Yeah. It wasn't on the sports fields that much, but I do appreciate that. And like, so like Peter Senge's work was really important to me pretty early on. And he has this great quote that your primary influence is the environment that you create. And so really being pretty thoughtful about like, when you bring people together, how do you bring them together? How do you help them ask the right questions that they need to be asking of themselves and one another to really co-imagine a change in the area that they're doing work in, and then co-create that and make that happen. So I've been on my own. My not very imaginatively named consulting firm is Halliday and Associates. It's me, but when I realized that I didn't have to pay my associates, I'm rich with associates. So a big collaborator. And I do a lot of work. People hire me really in the Rocky Mountain West around sort of social welfare issues. So health, education, early childhood, housing. A group will come together either at the community level, the state level, sometimes a regional level, and say, like, how can we come together and using the experiences, the knowledge, wisdom, and the resources we have, how can we really like do something important in this one area? And so, you know, as you know, this work is so complex that a lot of the challenge is, where are those points of leverage that will really have an impact on the people and the oftentimes the families that they're hoping to have better options in their lives. So I guess the only other thing I'd say, just to kind of ground folks in me, because I'll be talking about it a little bit, is that there was a time for about 8 years prior to being on my own that I worked for our state education agency, the Office of Public Instruction, under the leadership of this wonderful woman, Denise Juneau, who was the first American Indian woman to be elected to statewide office in our country's history at the time, which is kind of crazy. And so she built some very ambitious programs around high school dropout prevention called Graduation Matters Montana, and then Montana Schools of Promise, which worked in Indian country with our lowest performing public schools. And so I helped to build the initiatives that that led to some pretty significant changes and improvements in graduation rates and opportunities for Indian kids at public schools, and built a model to do that work that data was sort of a central component of.
Yeah, and how, when you are hired, you know, by say, you know, if the community level group is reaching out to you for help versus, you know, a, you know, city or state official, you know, in your experience, how did those projects tend to differ, if at all, like in terms of, you know, the focus of them or how long it takes to get things going or even outcomes? Like,
yeah, great question. So with local communities, oftentimes what happens is a group of folks start talking to one another about wanting to do something together, and they'll hire me to help them set some basic, well, I'll train them on collective impact, which for folks who are not familiar with that, it's a framework that helps to sort of describe the key components of multi-sector collaboration. So if you have nonprofit organizations and maybe city, county, or state government, some local just citizens who want to be part of things and are just folks who live in the community, sometimes businesses, they all sort of have different systems and different requirements, and they have different data that they work with and different cultures that they bring to how they make decisions and how they work together. And so all those people come into a room together and everyone has sort of has an assumption of what this work is. What does it mean to collaborate? What are the tools we need? What's the speed with it in which we can get up and running and have impact? And so they'll hire me to do some coaching, some training around collective impact, which sort of describes, like, you know, we need a common agenda. We need to sort of all agree on the thing that we're doing. So of all the things we could do, what are we actually doing here? You know, what's our measurement, our shared measurement, like all the data that we navigate? Is there any of that data that's already accessible that can be of use to our work? And if not, what's within our sort of capacity to get? How do we communicate with one another, both aspirationally and transparently, so that we're building trust and we're keeping momentum going? And then there's a backbone function, which is sort of the staffing, the conveners, the facilitators of all of that. So they're just sort of basic concepts that most collaborations and coalitions initiatives sort of have to address in one way or another. And the idea is that the more you have sort of shared language to talk about those things, the easier it is to sort of simplify something that's really complex. So the difference, I'd say, you know, local communities, you have a lot of optimism, you have a lot of excitement, you have a lot of urgency. Oftentimes something's really happening that's affecting families and people want to get right on it. So there's a real willingness to try to do things maybe differently, a lot of humility often around, like, let's think about this differently and take some risks together. State folks, oftentimes they get some really cool grants from the federal level that they have a little more latitude about how they structure, and they're really trying to figure out, like, how do I structure a grant program that emphasizes building capacity in local communities rather than the sort of regulatory checks and, you know, making sure everyone's doing the thing they're supposed to do things. So how do they build out their projects to really authentically engage the community and let the community have some, some autonomy to continue building what they're already building. Some of that is sort of like helping them think about, again, I'm a big believer in humility, helping people kind of slow down their assumptions a little bit. to ask the right questions and to engage the right conversations to make change happen.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Is the federal, because we hear about with philanthropy, you know, lately, also having that discussion about how to allow for more autonomy and, you know, not have people just afraid to even take the money because they're not going to have the capacity to do the reporting or whatever it is. But it's interesting to hear that with federal dollars as well, that there's, you know, thoughts around that, you know, on both sides of the funding coin.
Yeah, I've loved some of the conversations that are happening in philanthropy. They're just way overdue, right? And I really like this term trust-based philanthropy, where they're talking about like, how do we really, as you were saying, you know, grant people more autonomy and let people, you know, mess up, let people, heaven forbid, have operating support, you know? So hopefully there's some big shifts going on, because that this, the work of collective impact and collaboration in general tends to be sort of process heavy, to kind of really get at building that interstitial tissue between organizations and individuals. And that there's a belief, which I believe, that if you do this work well and you're deepening people's understanding of what's happening and what they could possibly do together, and the process deepens the relationships and the kind of co-investment and accountability to one another, as a community as a whole, they're more able to respond to or initiate things really in any area. If there's you know, you might be coming in to do some work around affordable housing, and then there's like a fire season, which happens out west a lot, as we know. And so, yeah, and so the relationships oftentimes in rural communities, people wear multiple hats, or they're married to the person who, you know, there's like, there's all this sort of the sort of non-hierarchical ecosystem. And so something might happen over here. If we really come together and do a good job with one another there, that naturally strengthens our ability to do some work over here. And so that is sort of a skillful diplomatic convening role that can really help communities be able to do that better.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about what you said around the process, you know, of working with, you know, once the stakeholders are all brought together, I don't know if stakeholders is the right way to describe the component people and organizations, but that's my language. But yeah, once people get together and, you know, you're training them kind of on what collective impact is, and then, you know, talking about the data that they each, you know, have and how they can bring that together. And, you know, I've been fascinated by this idea of, you know, data collectives or collaboratives. I know there's one in Connecticut that there was a great case study on. And just thinking about the impacts of, you know, say with homelessness, there's another organization from last summit that was, you know, data was at the core of them being able to get people housed, and, you know, having a way for the data to be shared between everybody was really important. And so with your work, how do you help people, you know, to share their data, especially with like community groups that maybe aren't so data literate? You know, you have like the professionals that really know their systems and their data, but then, you know, the other folks that are needed to participate and engage with it aren't so familiar. So how does that normally work? Or what are some of the ways that you've seen that work really well and some that maybe haven't worked so well?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Lori. Well, you know, I think of data as sort of part of the narrative and the sense making that communities do around their work. And so, like, I encourage folks fairly early on in their conversations with one another to, you know, where are we now? Where do we want to be? And how do we know that we're making progress in that? And then I also, you know, there's this great approach to data that comes out of Tamarack Institute, which is this great group out of, that does a lot of collective impact impact work in Canada, and I'd do some work for them in the lower 48. I always think that sounds cool, especially right now because the borders are closed. But yeah. But there's this term data light, learning heavy. And so it's like, you know, asking the right questions is more, isn't there like that Einstein thing of like, if I have an hour to solve something, I spend 59 minutes making sure I have the right question to ask. And then so I think that a lot of times people are either like, as you were saying, like really uncomfortable with data. And so they just kind of, want to either seed their power and seed their wisdom and their experience to sort of a statistician mindset. Or they just want to just pretend that data doesn't really matter, So it's like, it's helping groups really think about like, what do they already know? And what is it that they don't know enough about? And how do we sort of use data, qualitative and quantitative data, to help us better understand, first where we are, have that sort of help us inform where we want to go. And so for me, I think that the worst thing that can happen with data is that people sort of bring like a business industry Peter Drucker mindset into this work about, you can't improve what you don't measure, which, yep. Takes like, 80% of our knowledge and wisdom and experience and basically says it doesn't matter, So it's like, I think, so the first thing for me is
there's
like,
a lot of analysts that are going to be triggered.
my
analysts out there, just breathe through it. We'll make it.
Sorry. I love you.
Can't manage what you don't measure.
Corollary is that not everything that matters can be measured, and not everything that can be measured matters, right? And so, like, a lot of this work is, should I just do a moment of silence first? A lot of this work is like, this is really complex stuff, right? I mean, there's an urgency to people who have real needs, and there's political context that shifts, there's limited capacity, and there's like this huge amount of desire of people to make a real difference in the world. So it's kind of a loaded space when you think of it that way. And so a lot of what I do is I help people groups find the through line. Like, how do we take take our passion and our desire to make things different and better? And what, how do we sequence our work so that we're doing our best effort, our good enough effort to move it forward and learn as we go to continue to adjust? I think the one of the worst processes I have seen is where people say, well, we just need to get all the data and we'll crunch all the data and it will tell us what we need to do, And it's like, first of all, no one has capacity to do that. Second of all, most of the data is not relevant to the questions we're asking, probably because we haven't even stopped to figure out what the questions are we are asking. And fourth of all, if that's a fourth or second or sixth, is like, data is many things, but it doesn't replace experience and wisdom. It doesn't discern political context. It doesn't capture opportunities that are happening. So it's like having a balance of appreciation for what data does for us, but also a really healthy appreciation for what we need to do with one another to have a better chance at really evolving some of this work,
Yeah. And I like that you called out, the complexity, because I think most, why everybody's here is, these are big, wicked problems, as they call them, right? So
yes,
it's, something that it's not going to happen overnight. And, like you're saying, it's not going to be so simple as just having some stats, from the DA's office and being able to say, aha, we have fixed it. So,
yeah.
I have a soapbox speech about, the fact that, what you mentioned about, finding the through line and learning, as you're going, and that data piece of it is also something that can help you, to make an impact and to see the impact. And that if you're not kind of seeing it, that this long haul work that we need people to stay with it, everybody, don't give up and get yourself, you know, the data that can also help you sustain your efforts. And so that people aren't, you know, a year or two into things saying, well, you know, what have we done? I'm just, right. You know, I'm feeling defeated. That impact measurement is not just about the finish line, that it's about how you would even get there in years and generations.
Yeah. So, you know, I think a really good example for a really tangible example for me about how data is in service of this work in ways that have really worked in my work is like a data walk, right? And so you have a group of people together and you've compiled, you know, 5 to 7 data points. And that drives statisticians insane because they're like, to really understand this, you need 60. It's like, no, to really have people shut down and stop listening to you, you need 60. You know, it's like, what are the good enough data points that are illuminating enough for us to then have the conversations and make the connections together to figure out what we're going to do. So like a really good example in my world is I've done a ton of work in early childhood, and early childhood is, you know, getting more able to work with data and align systems, but it is a very complex world, that sort of 0 to 5 before you go to kindergarten. You've got, you know, families and friends helping each other. You've got home-based daycares, you have big centers, you have all this stuff, and no one really can talk to each other. And the need is, you know, grossly not met and whatever, you know. So it's hard for people to say, like, well, where would we even start in that, you know? And how do we know where we are now and if that's good enough? And so one of the proxy data points I've been able to use to pretty good effect is, at least in the Montana districts, are not so large that you can get kind of good enough data about how many kids are coming into kindergarten who need extra supports to kind of jump in and do the work. And then you can have a conversation with whoever you have around the table around, like, well, how does that kind of compare to your understanding of, you know, because we can get some other data from, you know, the state or the feds. So you start the conversation, like, how are we doing? And oftentimes you know, I think we're sort of hardwired to say the sky is falling, this is so important, you know, you've got to do something about it. But oftentimes we'll find that we're actually doing something really well. And then that's like part of the narrative of what makes change possible is like, hey, we actually do a beautiful job with, you know, with this particular aspect of this work, and how do we grow that? So, you know, with the data around kindergarten readiness is sort of the term that gets, some people don't like the term, but so I've tried to describe it a lot more complexly, but basically kindergarten is, you know, is you can figure out, well, where are kids coming from that are ready, and kids who need more supports, you know, is there any trend data of like coming from Head Start or coming from some big centers? Well, we were able to, the school district didn't have that. And so we put together a super simple survey, which, you know, everyone's like, there's no way the district's going to do that. We've been asking them to do that for years, but they were part of the conversation. They went through the data walk. They talked to teachers. They talked to employers. They talked to each other, which they often don't have time to do, you know, and they're all like, we get it. We need to know more about this to see where we might make our best good enough step forward, you know. And so they did, they got some pretty easy data from parents, and were able to say, okay, so the majority of kids who need extra supports are coming from homes, and they're coming from a few neighborhoods in our town. And so then it was, well, so then what do we know about what already exists that's already in those neighborhoods to support those families? And what do they know? Those practitioners are way closer to this than we are, that what's been working and what might be able to do some more work. And so, you know, there were some sort of smaller efforts to do some outreach, community building, literacy effort kind of things with families in those neighborhoods. And so the school district was able to give them some resources to, like, let's beef up what you're doing. Let's not pretend no one's ever thought about this and create a whole new thing and watch it fail because we don't have relationships with families. You know, so it's like, so you can use modest amounts of data to great effect if you keep people in the conversation and you structure, you know, back at it's Peter Senge's, you know, the environment, your primary influence is the environment you create. If you create a trusting space for people to be not defensive, not attacking, but be curious about how might we do this better working alongside one another, with a little bit of data and a lot of conversation and trust building, you can actually do some pretty cool things, you know?
Yeah. And are you finding that people are still able to, you know, we often hear that, I don't know if there's a saying, but, you know, the observation that people in communities will work together on improving their community, and they, you know, that it's not, you know, they care about the quality of their schools, and that is not a political or partisan thing that anybody would, you know, ever think of worrying about. And so, you know, as increasingly people's identities are wrapped up in some of their politics, are you finding it, are you seeing that affect how you're able to create those trusting environments or what you have to do to keep everybody working together at the table?
Yeah, beautiful question. So I'm very sad to report that Montana has become more polarized. We really were able to, you know, as a state, we have sort of a healthy disregard for the feds. and so when all the cray cray has been happening and building and building and building over the last, you know, generation plus, Montana was pretty able to kind of just hold its space and hold its own as being a populist state where it's a purple state, you know, usually where you have sort of equal balance of Republicans and Democrats being elected, and the federal dialogue is not, you know, all that impacting our local communities. That has changed really significantly, and really just but only in the, like, the last 2 years, 2.5 years. So while you know, our legislature has done some funky things and the letters to the editor are amping up, and, you know, there's definitely the temperature is coming up. It's still so deeply, and I'm trying to think, am I being naive and aspirational here? But it's still pretty deeply baked into Montana. And I work around the region, but I'm thinking specifically of Montana right now. It's still pretty baked into us to work together, to work across the, you know, aisle or what have you on issues. And so, and people vote with their feet in collaboration, right? People aren't like forced to collaborate with each other. So okay. I tend to see the people who want to work together and believe that working together, but even saying that, it is absolutely a nonpartisan frame that we do this work in. And I know that, you know, when I was driving all around the state doing Graduation Matters Montana 6 years ago, I was working with lots of people who have different political opinions than I do. So what the things that I do around that to sort of minimize the likelihood that will be kind of overtake the work at hand, I'm a really big believer in, you know, extraordinarily good facilitation. It's one of the things that I do most and most well is I design and facilitate group process. And so, and there's lots of people who do that. But it's like taking seriously, like, this stuff is complex. People are really busy. They need to really know that when they spend time on this project, they have so many things to do. When they spend time on this one, their time will be well spent. Their voice will be heard. They'll have a sense of growing belonging and investment in one another. Like, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Is so the relational pieces of that are really, really critical, I think, to keeping people, like I was mentioning as we were opening, just our getting to know each other, that I just participated in the Othering and Belonging Institute conference just as an attendee. And one of the things they kept saying about, like, how do we step back from the othering that's happening is that we need to slow down and recomplexify one another, that we're not just, you know, these sort of you know, crass oversimplification of party or race or gender or, you know, what have you, that we're also family members and knitters and book readers. And, you know, it's like we have to rehumanize one another. And so I loved that. And it really connected for me because so much of my work is holding the possibility of deepening our humanity with one another and with the people that we're trying to help, obviously. And so there's a process there. There's also principles that I'm pretty intentional about co-creating with people around, like, how do we strive to work together, naming those, creating those together. And then again, as a facilitator, modeling, holding ourselves accountable to that, to the point where the people in the group hold each other to that accountability. And then actually National Equity Center has some really beautiful sort of group norms that I use all the time that are things like, you know, we expect it will get messy and we listen to understand and, you know, we sort of recognize that we all come into this space from different places. So, you know, different ages, different levels of education, different lengths of time we've been engaged with this particular issue. And that's what makes us, that's what makes it possible for us to have some hope that we might actually do something different and better this time. We're not about conforming and hierarchy. And so those kinds of things, I think, kind of build that trust. There's that great quote that gets used a lot, at least in the collective impact field, from Stephen Covey, that progress moves at the speed of trust. Mm-hmm. And so really recognizing that that's so central to the work. And then the progress part does have some, that's a huge place where data plays a role, is how do you, again, how do you sort of know what's your best understanding of where you are and where you want to be and how you know you're getting there. But if you don't, I feel like I'm throwing all these half remembered, half misquoted quotes at you. What's that one about, like, culture eats progress for lunch or something?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? So it's like, this is human work, you know, mm-hmm. and we can't hide behind data and we can't let data do the work for us, you know?
So regarding the, you know, what you mentioned about recomplexifying, I can imagine that in a rural setting, that's something that should actually, in theory, come more easily, because people are wearing multiple hats, like you see it there, like people know each other. And I'm in a more rural area of a, you know, state that's not considered to be a rural state, but definitely in regions, right, the dynamics change, even, you know, in these popular states. So I wanted to also kind of segue into talking more about your, I think, Graduation Montana?
Graduation Matters Montana.
Graduation Matters Montana, because it sounds like a really great, you know, case study and illustration of a lot of these points that you've been talking about so far.
Yeah, thanks. I would agree with you that rural areas allow the complexity to happen a little more easily. It's, you know, we don't really, at least like most of our communities, all the schools are public schools. So there's not a big private school, you know, white flight happening. Everyone's together. And, you know, we only have a few grocery stores. So it's hard to, you know, it's hard to over assume people when they come flopping into the grocery store and buying two boxes of ho-hos. Like, maybe I like that person after all. Maybe she threw some of those ho-hos, you know? But so I would agree with that. So Graduation Matters Montana is actually a great example of using data well. So one thing I would say, you asked earlier, Lori, about sort of state initiative or state work versus community. And I kind of immediately went into how they intersect with each other. So Graduation Matters Montana was an initiative of state, then State Superintendent Denise Junos at the Office of Public Instruction. So as a state agency, we had a ton of data, right? Because all the schools have to report to the state agency. And then what usually happens is the state agency just makes sure it's clean and then sends it to the feds. And that's the extent to which that data stream gets gets explored, you know? Mm-hmm. And so what we were able to do is give people back the data that we gathered, and we formatted it in a very user-friendly way. And so any district in the state, we could say how many kids graduated, how many kids dropped out. We could break that. We could disaggregate that data by race and income. We could take it by grade, how many kids are dropping out of each of the high school grades. We could also do the good enough proxy for college going was about, was that, I can't remember. It might've been something sort of like in the ACT kind of place. So we would literally have like a one pager that had your community, Montana, US or something, you know, the three, you know, maybe, you know, and, I'm a big believer in that maxim that you need to be writing to a fifth grade level, learning reading level. And that's not being patronizing. It's like for any of us, the more we can simplify our language and simplify the information, you get that barrier of kind of freezing up and, oh my God, I'm not smart enough and all the smart people know what they're doing and I can't say anything now. You know, you take that away so that people, and you, so I would have very simple data and then I would spend most of my time thinking about what are the two or three critical questions that I want to engage groups around at the local level? And so what are you noticing about this? How does this sort of square for you with what you understand is happening? You know, what's good about this or not so good about it? And then there's always a question about like, what more would you want to know? You know, and then there's like, I believe that data needs to be actionable and needs to be progressive and that it helps you move forward. So like, based on what we now understand, what does that mean for us moving forward? What might our next step be, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the framework of Graduation Matters Montana, which was pre-collective impact, it's actually kind of how I got into the collective impact community, was I built this framework and then found these guys and was like, hey, they seem like people who think about things like I think about things. So it was team, data, practice, communicate. So the team is a multi, you know, a diverse group of people, the students, some teachers, some administrators, some nonprofits in the community, some individuals who really care about this. Get your team together, look at your data, qualitative and quantitative. So the qualitative data, we were able to give them pretty good data that was like kind of got them into the conversation. And then qualitative is like, what do we know about the experience kids who are dropping out or struggling to stay in schools are having? And so we modeled focus groups and different ways to do that. So we'd ask that team to move through that learning agenda, that kind of that you know, data light, learning heavy culture, you know, and then that got us to practice. It's like, what might we do? What might we grow that we already have? What might we want to learn from other communities that are sort of same size as ours, and do some different things? And then communicate. We sort of communicate and celebrate. How do we let constantly go outward facing with what we're doing so that people don't feel like it's just this little star chamber of people who are doing all this stuff, but really modeling that this is, you know, we're always learning. We're always trying to expand the conversation and it's really bringing people together to engage with one another around this thing. So the data was very powerful and with rural communities, one of the things kind of interesting, and you've probably experienced this as well, is our numbers are small enough that you can imagine them. Mm-hmm. So if you look at a number like, you know, did you know that 55,768, blah, 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 and you're like, what the hell is 5,050? Your brain doesn't, we're not built that way. You know, but we can imagine maybe, I don't know, I can probably imagine 50 or something, like 50 cars. You think about like a parking lot or, you know, 100 or maybe, but 17, you know? And so our numbers, particularly when you break it down by grade, all of a sudden it's like, oh, 18 kids dropped out of junior year at our high school. We could do something about that, you know? And right. It becomes, it demystifies the potential to have real impact. And it grounded everybody in like that thing of like, where are we now? Where do we want to be? And so some of our larger districts, you know, large for us is 55,000 people in the community. Some of them dropped their dropout rate by 50% over 2 years, you know, and it's just because they had the data in front of them, which sort of gave them hope that they could change it, because it wasn't just this amorphous amoebus kind of thing. And then the framework that we had, and then we would bring all the community, we had like over 50 communities in Montana running this framework. We'd bring them all together for these like super fun curated day and a half learning, you know, times together, and people learned from each other and shared what was working and not working. And we created this whole community of practitioners around that. And data was a very central part of that. And sort of data kind of called BS on the, oh, it always happens. It's more than, you know, we try what we can try, you know.
Yeah.
Come on, really? You can't bring that down from 30 to 15 if you do a few things here, if you talk to some kids and figure out what's going on, you know.
Yeah. That's a really great point, you know, about that. If you are bringing people along, you know, I say people who are watching a lot of summit sessions are probably going to start noticing me saying this comment about the failure of imagination of, you know, other people. You know, if you're someone who's would be an organizer, a social impact leader, you've got, you know, this passion, and you can see that there's something that you can do. Problems have solutions, and say like, so, but yet you go and try to take action and find partners, and you know, you run up against the, oh well, that's the way it is. And you know, how is that gonna, you know, some people don't want to get off the streets, you know, how are we gonna, you know, fix that? But like you said, you know, with that data, it doesn't have to be fancy or huge, but it does help people get their imaginations off of the bench and at the table.
Yeah. And I would add that, you know, that whole, you know, if you see data as lending itself to narrative, and you know, like I often will get on my soapbox about the value of doing, I call it 100 cups of coffee. Like whenever you start a new initiative, everyone should go out and literally, you know, have a Zoom coffee or have a cup of coffee with, you know, 10 to 15 people and from all sorts of facets of the work that you're doing, and ask them, you know, tell me about a time when our community really came together and made a difference. Well, who was involved? What was the issue? What was surprising about that? You know, how have you seen people try to tackle this issue that we're working on right now in the past? And where do you see our community does a really good job with this issue? And where do you see that we're really flat-footed on it? And, you know, if you had a magic wand, what would, you know? And so you engage people in like a 45-minute super generative, you know, the statisticians are always like, well, let's put that into a, you know, a form and we can do the word count data thing. And so it's like, no, we're just gonna write some notes. And at the end of it, you have your three main takeaways. You pop that to the rest of the group. Everyone analyzes the three main takeaways from all these different areas. And you start to co-construct a narrative about what's happening in this community, what might make it change. And then you go, you know, or maybe not, it can happen at the same time, but there's the qualitative data about really working with where people are at and what they're thinking about. And then you're more, maybe potentially strategic about what quantitative data will help them go deeper. Like, wow, people really, like your example about people on the streets, like people really misunderstand that issue. They're clearly not talking to the people who are way more aware of that issue or people who are experiencing that themselves. They don't know that there are 150 people when the temperature dropped to negative 20. You know, it's like, what's some of the data that would create a sense of urgency with those who are complacent? And then what are some of the data points that would really help us start moving it forward? Because our job as change makers, as community builders, is to honor where people are at and then help them move it forward, right?
Right. Exactly. Everything you said, exactly. All the time, everybody. And you know, we're unfortunately we're coming up on time, and I definitely wanted to give you the opportunity to you know, make any announcements or calls to action or plug anything that you would want to at this time.
Thank you, Lori. I don't have much. I mean, I blog once in a while, not nearly as often as I aspire to, but the good thing about that is I only really blog when I feel like blogging, which usually makes the blogs better.
Yeah, they are very good. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. So if you are curious about my work and sort of how I think about the work, I have a website, debhalliday.com, and on there you'll see the blogs that I do. And, you know, I am always thirsty for this kind of connection with others and to live in this broader community of people doing this work. And so, you know, if people want to engage in whatever way, I really welcome that. It feeds my soul. I've been looking forward to this conversation ever since you reached out to me, because I think this is this kind of heart to heart in the hearth to hearth, you know, is what keeps us moving this work forward in a good way.
Hey there, listener. I know you care about our mission to create and empower a globally connected community of people who are using data and technology to create positive social change. With your support right now, you'll help us build a better world, one in which any person who wants to use the tools of the digital age to solve the problems they see in their community is empowered, supported, and effective in creating measurable change. There are three simple ways you can support our work: an annual paid membership, a one-time donation, or a recurring donation. Just go to civic-hackers.org/nonprofit to learn more and make your contribution. Your donation today will allow us to ensure that more communities benefit from data and technology projects focused on increasing access to benefits, informing the electorate, advocating for peace and equal justice, serving the vulnerable, and many other issues. It's very easy to donate, so head on over to civic-hackers.org/nonprofit today. Thank you for choosing to support Civic Hacker Network programs and this podcast. Problems have solutions. Let's get to work. Thank you so much to Deb for giving us such important insight into collective impact frameworks and collaboration and how to use data to cultivate an environment that can produce real positive outcomes in our communities. You'll want to learn more from her by checking out her blog at debhalliday.com. Deb welcomes anyone who wants to engage, because building these communities are so important and keeps us moving forward. So don't be shy about reaching out to her. And I'd love to hear from you. Are you engaged in any collective impact or other collaborative initiatives in your community? Or maybe you would like to start one to move the needle on an issue in your community. Drop me a line anytime. I want to hear about it. My email is Lori, L-O-R-I, at civic-hackers.org. Or you can always leave a voice message by heading over to civic-hackers.org/pod. As always, wrapping up this episode, we've got that gratitude attitude. We humans come together for many reasons, and I'm grateful for all of the times we managed to lock arms and work together for the good of the collective. I'm really thankful to Deb, and thankful for practitioners like her who lead, teach, and enable people to come together and use data well without neglecting the human work that's required to start making changes to the aspects of civic life that we all know need improving. I'm thankful for the people who, over the ages, have cared for the beautiful land in far northern California where I produce this podcast. It is with gratitude I acknowledge the Wintu people. This is their current and ancestral home, and I'm committed to supporting work that they lead to meet the needs of their people. I want you to know how grateful I am to you for listening. I welcome your feedback because it helps me improve this podcast and better serve the network. I hope you'll take a moment to do me a favor and rate the show and share it with your people. These small actions can help other people discover this podcast and the amazing work of the people we feature. Please follow the Civic Hacker Network on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and claim your free membership. That gets you an invitation to join us on Slack. You can find all of the links on our website, civic-hackers.org. I'm Lori McNeil, wishing you all the good things between now and your next listen to the Civic Hacker Podcast. Problems have solutions. Let's get to work. The Civic Hacker Podcast is a production of Civic Hacker Network, a networking and support hub for people using data and technology to create positive change in their communities. The audio is edited by Lily Conway, and Kate Allison writes our scripts. The Civic Hacker Network is a nonprofit organization fiscally hosted by the Open Collective Foundation. Join the network for free at civic-hackers.org.